Let's come back to the idea of getting a Christian theory of reality. And we've seen now how assuming different divinity beliefs can lead to very different views of what math is about and how it's to be done. Not just adding a column of figures, but the theories of math and how it works and why and whether it does and to what extent. Let's take this and transpose it to theories of reality. Theory of reality is trying to find the basic nature of everything. That means everything that we would call creation, that Christians would call creation. God's not in theory. We're not making a theory about God. It's about creation, the universe, the cosmos, the multiverse, whatever term you want to use for it. And over the years, I made this point earlier, people have distinguished the kinds of characteristics that they observe this reality in which we live to have. So people have observed that it has quantity. And we've cooked up a number series to represent the quantity, and then we look for laws that hold among those quantities. We've observed that things have spatial characteristics. They have size, they have shape, they have location, they have kinetic properties as well. They're able to move or be moved, and they're physical. They have properties such as solidity, mass, weight, density. Some have biotic properties. They also are alive. They include all these others, but the biotic is added. They carry on life functions. They carry on metabolic processes. Some of those, not all of them, are also sensory. They perceive, feel, emote. Plants go here. Most animals go here. There's then also the aspect of logic. Things not only are governed by logical laws, they cannot both be and not be in any sense at the same time, in the same sense at the same time. But that guides our thinking. Our thinking has to be guided by not contradicting ourselves, because no thing that created thing can actually contradict itself. It can't both be and not be in the same sense at the same time. There's an historical or formative aspect to the world as we experience it. I explained this a little earlier. History is the past formative control that humans have exercised over nature. Whenever we take a natural material and make something new, we have then engaged in this kind of practice. And one of the first things humans do that with is language. We take sounds or marks and take them to make a symbolic system in which they represent something else. And that's what makes real society possible. And then we also get social relationships such as respect, deference, honor or dishonor. There are when society arises, we notice that it also has an economic aspect. That things really are valued. Objects are really subject to the law of supply and demand and diminishing returns and other such norms. Notice that there's a difference here between the way these lower aspects obey laws and the way the upper ones do. Lower aspects are bound to the laws and can't break them. There's no way we can break a mathematical, spatial, physical law. But as the law order of these kinds of properties, as we ascend up the list, the law order is looser. When we get to here with the logical, it's not only that things really can't break the law of logic, the laws of logic, but then they become norms for our thinking. Objects may not be able to both be and not be in the same sense at the same time, but we can make mistakes. We can construct a theory that actually has a contradiction in it if we don't recognize it. We're not aware of it. So that becomes a norm for thought. A norm means it's an order that's natural to this kind of properties, but which it is possible for humans to violate. Humans can also violate linguistic norms, social norms, economic norms, but the norm comes back and shows itself, because if you violate the linguistic norm, what you say isn't clear and people don't understand you correctly. You violate a social norm, you may be ostracized. Violate an economic norm, and you'll go broke. We have juridical norms, laws we make about justice. We experience things and actions to be just and unjust. That's not our invention. The laws that try to deal with that and ensure justice and punish injustice are our inventions. But there's a real juridical side to human life. Aesthetic, when we recognize that something is beautiful, just as an example. Ethical, when we find that some things are loving or not. I'm going to identify the ethical or moral aspect of our lives with the human love life. Whereas the juridical has to do with what is just or unjust, the ethical has to do with what's loving or unloving. And then finally, there's the aspect that I called juridical. We were over these pretty quickly, but been a while back, so it may help you to hear them again. Juridical has to do with the trustworthiness of things. And at the upper end of the juridical, of the fiduciary, at the very upper end is what we trust most and what we trust to be most trustworthy. And that coincides with whatever we regard as self-existent. So that kind of trust is called faith. Faith is trust that's unconditional. We trust what we trust to be unconditional is thereby regarded as self-existent. Our trusting of it is called faith. And that faith is not blind. It's not a blind leap into the dark by any means. So these are what we have to work with in a theory of reality. So the interesting thing to us from the standpoint of these is that objects, types of objects, exhibit different combinations of these. Let's just take a quick look at a couple of examples. I'm going to leave this up now for the rest of our sessions. And let's point out that these items on this list are supposed to be kinds of properties with their laws. Kinds of properties, quantitative properties with quantitative laws that hold among them. Spatial properties with spatial laws that hold among them. Physical properties with physical laws that hold among them, and so on. Logical laws and so forth. And I'm going to take the ordinary English word aspect and press it into being a technical term. These are going to be called aspects of reality. They're aspects of reality that we experience. That's how we know about them in the first place. But take a look at this and see if it makes some sense to you. If I take an object such as a rock, it seems pretty obvious that the rock has quantity, occupies space, is capable of moving, and has physical properties such as a hard tensile surface, and it's very dense and has a lot of weight to it. The rock, however, is not alive. It doesn't perceive, it doesn't think, it doesn't create artifacts, it doesn't speak. And yet there's a sense in which these other aspects are aspects of the rock also. The rock does these things, has these properties, whether anybody knows it or not. So I'm going to say that it possesses those properties actively, as opposed to possessing others passively. That is, the rock is not alive, but it can be the object of a living thing's needs, desires. It can be part of its nest. This can be the rock the seagull drops the clams on to open them. It can be a tiny rock that a bird swallows and it goes into its gizzard and helps to grind its food. It takes part in a life process without itself being alive. So it's passively biotic. Similarly, the rock doesn't perceive, but it can be perceived. It doesn't think, but we can form a concept of it. It doesn't form artifacts, but it can be formed so as to become one. We can take the rock and carve a statue out of it. That's a beginning of looking for a theory of reality, of looking for a way to get at the natures of things. And our first step will be to say that we're going to accept this list in which people have worked for centuries, And we're going to look for the ways that things are governed by the laws of those aspects, actively or passively. And the first proposal is going to be that everything in creation functions under the laws of all these aspects and has properties of all the kinds, either actively or passively. That's a stunning reversal of the history of non-Christian thought, which has always taken one or two of these and said, this is the divine, and everything is either this or caused by this, and we'll trace all of causal efficacy to this one or two things. No, this says, oh, there are all kinds of things, and they have all kinds of properties, and they're governed by all kinds of laws. Does the rock also function passively in the juridical aspect? Oh, sure. That rock can be part of my property. I own it. That rock could be a murder weapon, a piece of evidence in court. What about ethical? Well, the rock doesn't love or be kind and be merciful to other things. But the rock could be something I hate. It could be the object of my love or hate. I just love the way this rock goes into the garden. It really makes things look great. Or, damn, every time I try to walk past that thing, I stumble over it. I'm going to go get the sledgehammer and bash it one. Get it rid of it so I'm not tripping over it. It can be the object of my love or hate. It can also be an object that I trust in some respect. I trust to stand up to the weather and continue to be part of that garden and making it look good. Of course, it would be definitely positively weird if you trusted that rock above all other things and thought that it was the most real thing that generated everything else. In that case, it would be a divinity to you, and you would be regarding the rock as divine and the source of everything else. That's positively strange, but people have done strange things when it comes to that. It's not too far from what some tribal religions have been like. There are tribal religions that have deified very odd things at times. So, and we'll talk about that as well. But can you see this is a way to start that's the opposite from what you'd want to do if some part of the cosmos, the world in which we live, was divine, had divine self-existence, and generated everything else. So here we're saying, no, the only thing that's divine and generates all of these is God. And God doesn't come into the theory. God's not a postulate of the theory. Because we believe in God, we're going to theorize, we're going to philosophize this way. And we're going to look for how things function with respect to the different kinds of properties and their laws. So let me just make a comparison here quickly. A plant, then, would have one additional aspect in which it functions actively. It's actively alive. It carries on metabolic processes. Does it feel and emote? I don't think so. I know some people suspect that may be true. But so far as we know, feelings and sensations require a certain neural network to exist. We don't know of anything that actually perceives or feels without that kind of a nervous system. So I'm going to say it functions only passively in that aspect. And logically, we can form a concept of it, and we can form it into something else, and we can give it a name, and so on. Now, in Dooyeweerd's theory, when he comes to animals, he says that the animal would be represented this way. It functions in a sensory way that a plant does not. The animal perceives, feels, reacts. And then he says that the logical is true only of humans. But I've got to say that I'm convinced that at least some of the higher animals have some logical function. I think you probably all know about Coco the gorilla, who was taught the deaf sign language and has carried on conversations with her handlers. They asked Coco what she wanted for her birthday. She signed a kitten. So they got her a kitten, and she signed "My Cat Good." I think that certainly shows an abbreviated, stunted logical ability and linguistic ability. So I'm not willing to draw the line where Dewey did. I think it can go higher. We noticed, however, that Coco, neither Coco nor the other apes that have been taught the deaf sign language, they're not able to ask questions. If you ask them a question, they can answer it, and often they do, but they can't frame a question. They can't understand a hypothetical. If this were this way, would you want... They can't get that. There are all kinds of very narrow limits to this, but it's real. And I don't see that it hurts anything to admit that and go ahead and work with the theory. We're going to find that this isn't the only sort of grid that lets us zero in on the natures of things around us. Dewey's going to propose at least two more. And then we're going to see that this will give us an account of the natures of artifacts as well as natural things. Something, insofar as I know, hasn't even been tried since Aristotle tried it and gave up. I hope you're getting this. Take a look at it again, read the assignment, and we'll meet again and I'll review it.